Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis, and this is a very different show. This is going to be really, really exciting. We're going to talk about the book Takedown. And Takedown is about, it has three authors, Jeff Buck, Lindsay Presson, and the author that's here that I'm really excited about, John Land, the author of my favorite series, Caitlin Strong. And, of course, I'm waiting for Michael Turion to come back because he's too hot not to have any more books about him. Jeff thought he'd seen it all. 20 years working undercover in the netherworld of drugs had left him burned out and grateful to assume the quiet job of police chief in Reminderville, Ohio. Watch what happens when he gets back into the swing, and watch what happens when he has to take down some very serious drug cartel people. So I am really excited, and I want to welcome John Land. Hi, how are you?
Fran, it's great to, you know, anytime someone's excited about talking to me, I get excited because it doesn't happen that often.
No, it's great because you bring some energy, a lot of energy.
And it's the morning.
So I read this. It's beautiful outside. It's about 70 degrees here in New York.
Oh, it's gorgeous. Gorgeous. Spring is in the air.
I thank God because the snow could stay away from me. It's very depressing when it snows, and I hate it. So it's beautiful. It puts me in a whole better frame of mind, if I can find my mind.
I think that's true of everybody.
I received this book as a surprise. I often do, John knows, people just throw books in the mail and they don't tell me they're coming. And I looked at this and I go, okay, am I going to be able to handle it? It's fantastic. I couldn't put it down. As a matter of fact, I emailed Jeff Buck with the review and he was thrilled for my kind words. I just wanted him to know what we were saying about him. So when did you decide to take on this project? And how do you work it with one does the facts, one tells you the information, one does the research, and I take it you put it all together. How does that work?
Well, Lindsay Preston, my co-writer, is a very noted ghostwriter who's ghostwritten books for some very, very big names, none of which I'm able to reveal, none of which I even know because she has these non-disclosure agreements. So she was working potentially with Chief Jeff Buck, who's still chief of police in Reminderville, Ohio. She had been introduced to Jeff and his story. And as soon as she interviewed him for the first time, she had a sense that this was too big a story to just do as a ghost-written book that wouldn't get any promotion, that might not find a publisher. So we've been friends a long time. She called me. We always wanted to work on a project together. I was very well aware of her skills, especially as an interviewer. And, you know, she basically started the conversation by saying, did you know more drugs come over the Canadian border than the Mexican border? And I went, what? And then she followed that up by saying, what would you think about a nonfiction book about a small-town police chief, former undercover drug officer, who comes out of retirement to take on a drug gang comprised of the Hells Angels, a corrupt Indian reservation, and the Russian mob. And I said, sign me up. Visions of, you hear visions of mistletoe from the Christmas music and everything.
Yeah.
Well, for me, it's visions of the New York Times bestseller list. It's visions of another career path, another opportunity in narrative nonfiction. Of course, the truth is, if I had known everything I know now about the work it took to write Takedown, I might not have done it in the first place, but now I'm so glad I did because I can't tell you how proud I am of the finished product. I just think what your review is mirroring what pretty much everyone else is saying. And here's the thing I take such great pride, solace, comfort in. Everyone is saying what you've said about how riveting the book is, how they can't put it down. But this is not, when you hear all the things I just said, I'm overselling it to you the way I oversold it to myself. Because here's the fact. The drug world, and this is going to sound crazy, the drug world, save for the Mexican cartels and the Hells Angels themselves, especially north of the border, is not a violent world. Jeff Buck, in his 25 years working undercover, almost never carried a gun when he was working because the real kingpins in this business are businessmen. We tell a story about this multimillionaire drug dealer who was also, he had a meatpacking business. And the reason he had a meatpacking business was because he could take frozen sides of beef, hollow them out,
put the drugs in,
stuff cash inside them, ship them across the Canadian border in trucks with permits. They would be delivered to drug dealers who would take the cash out of the beef and replace it with drugs. And then the truck would come back across the border, fully licensed, fully permissible. So I had a story that was procedural, that was gritty, that was noir, that was filled with these Shakespearean bad guys and these corrupt, you know, these corrupt Indians and the corrupt Akwesasne Indians from upstate New York. And the fascinating thing was, you assume, with all this attention to the southern border, Donald Trump wants to build a wall with Mexico. Well, the Mexican border is 2,000 miles long. There are 22,000 Border Patrol agents responsible for it, patrolling it.
Wow.
The Canadian border, let's talk about the Canadian border. 5,000 miles long, only 2,000 Border Patrol agents responsible. That's one-tenth of the agents for pretty much for an area 2.5 times the size. One of the 9/11 hijackers came into this country through the Indian reservation, the Akwesasne Mohawk Nation, that we talk about in this book. The millennial bomber was going to come in through Washington. They weren't coming in through Mexico. So when you look at the problems, the drugs, this heroin that's killing people in the Northeast, Vermont and New Hampshire, everyone's talking about it. It's not coming from Mexico. It's coming
from
Canada.
Canada. That is scary. You know what really helped, though? Because a lot of authors don't do it when there's a lot of people involved. Stephen Schwarzerly did it in Revenge Unleashed and in his first book, Enemy of the Heartland, which made it easier. There were 2 million characters. But when you decided, it gets hard. But when you decided to put all the players in order, starting with Yulia, and then Alan Jacobs, of course, he's that main guy, and all of them, I was able to go back and forth. Well, I remembered everybody, but I was able to go back and forth. But that opening scene of that poor child that gets killed at the beginning is what got me through the story. And, of course, it says in the front, this is a true story, though some names and details have been changed. And the prologue is enough to bring tears to your eyes. That was
and all the more
brilliant.
Shattering because it's true. Yeah. And what you're referring to is the death of Daniel DeRocha, an 11-year-old boy in a suburb of Montreal. And part of a big portion of our book relies on the biker wars in Canada between the Hells Angels and the Rock Machine, which is, and he was, you know, he was collateral damage. This little boy was collateral damage in that war. And basically, what the biker wars were about was control of the drug trade throughout Canada, but mostly in Montreal, where it all is centered, and all the marijuana grow houses, British Columbia, BC Bud it's called. And after they vanquished the Rock Machine and to restock their coffers because they had spent so much money and lost so many people to that war, the Hells Angels started smuggling marijuana through this Indian reservation, you know, weed and pills through this Indian reservation. And here's the terrifying thing. There are no borders. This is an Indian reservation that straddles Canada and the United States. So you can go from the Canadian side of the reservation to the American side of the reservation. There is no border.
Nobody stops you.
And here's the even scarier thing. Because this is sovereign land, and because of that statistic I mentioned earlier about the number of Border Patrol agents responsible for the entire Canadian border, there are multiple spots where you can just drive out of the Akwesasne Reservation, and you just, remember, that's America. So the drugs are coming in from Canada. They're coming from the Canadian side of this reservation. And then now you're in the United States, technically. you're on an Indian reservation, sovereign land, and now you just drive the drugs out, and this is where the Russian mob came in. The Indians were the consolidators in this deal. They were the ones taking the drugs, bringing in the drug runners, and then the Russian mob were the distributors throughout the entire country. Our story begins, and it's a fascinating, almost, as I said, it's almost Shakespearean. And you can't, it's the little, you know, it's literally the definition of you can't make this stuff up. Jeff Buck had retired from this world. He'd done it for long enough. It was, you know, you get to the point where you can't do it anymore. And he's a small town police chief, and he gets called in on a domestic abuse case where a Russian woman is beating the hell out of her Russian boyfriend, has to be held back. There's holes in the walls. The guy's all bloody, broken. And they arrest the woman, and they put her in jail, and she's terrified that she's going to stay in jail. So she says to Jeff Buck, "I know a drug dealer in Beechwood, a neighboring town. I'll give you his name if you let me go." And Jeff says, "Well, what's his name?" "Kevin. Kevin from Beechwood." Believe it or not, Jeff the next day or a few days later goes to the Beechwood Police Department and says, "I've got an informant telling me that you've got a drug dealer, in this a huge drug dealer in this town, a Russian named Kevin." And the two cops he's talking to are like flabbergasted, and they went, "Chief, how did you know?" So this all started. Jeff Buck all got back into his old world in the undercover drug trade because of a domestic abuse case where a woman beat up her boyfriend. And usually you would think it would be the other way around. So it's literally stuff that if I had written in one of my Caitlin Strong books, you know, as opposed to writing it for Real and Takedown, people would have gone, "Come on, that's ridiculous." But it wasn't. And here's the fun of this book. And as I said, there's no car chases. There's only one gunfight, if you want to even call it that. Here, the fun of this book is the minutiae. It tells two stories. It tells the story of Jeff Buck's involvement and how he put together this task force that ultimately won the day.
Yeah.
But it also tells the story, set a year in the past, of the events that directly led up to his involvement that include the murder of a former Marine who is also Shakespearean in the fact that he just wants to do something better for his family. The problem with what you want to make more money is you make bad choices. And this young man made a bad choice. He basically went against his boss. He started working for himself. Once his boss finds out, the guy ends up getting killed. And now everything starts to spiral. And the fun of this book is in watching Jeff Buck put all these things together. It's this mosaic together. Even as he's working with in his own language and telling these anecdotes, and there are so many great anecdotes in this book.
I mentioned
the one about the sides of beef. I mean, Jeff Buck was undercover at a Grateful Dead trucking tour stop in the 90s in Ohio, in the woods. And, you know, the Deadwood is a band that would come to town, play two shows over the weekend, Saturday and Sunday, and people would start showing up on Thursday. Well, Jeff went undercover. He busted so many people in the campgrounds that police departments, municipalities locally began to get all these missing person reports. Because when you bust a dealer at a big venue, you don't let him go back to his friends and say, "I've just been arrested. I'm not going to be here for the rest of the weekend." Because then everyone gets word there's an undercover sting operation going on. So there were so many people arrested, dozens of dealers arrested, that nobody knew what happened to him. They just disappeared. But here's the kicker, and this is typical of Jeff Buck. He's arresting somebody for major distribution of LSD, and he notices the LSD they're selling, the strips of tabs of it, are embossed with a sunshine. Now, he knows, as does every drug cop in the country for years, that the biggest drug dealer in the country is known as Sunshine because of this moniker, this symbol he uses on his tabs. So in exchange for letting the guy go, he gets Sunshine's phone number, makes a deal with him, has him come to Ohio to make this huge buy of 5,000 strips, one of the biggest drug deals you can ever imagine. And he does it in a school parking lot. Why? Because it doubles the federal sentence. Sunshine the biggest drug LSD dealer in the country in the 90s at that time is still in federal prison. And that's the kind of guy Jeff Buck is. Here's the point. He doesn't – this is what makes Jeff Buck different and what we can all learn from Takedown about the drug world. Jeff does not stop at the neighborhood dealer. He does not stop even at the guy bringing the drugs to the neighborhood dealer. He wants to climb the food chain to take down the kingpin, to bring down the guy like the one smuggling the drugs through the sides of beef, not the driver of the truck crossing the border, the guy who owned the meatpacking company, because then what happens is this. That meatpacking company gets confiscated as the fruit of the forbidden tree. It becomes products of crime, assets and seizures, which Jeff Buck then seizes. And what allows him to make further cases, what allows him to build further cases against more bad guys, what allowed him to fund the investigation in Takedown that brought down all these bad guys, was money from cases like the meatpacking guy, because when you seize somebody's property, you take the money. And the money goes into your drug fund. But here's the kicker. Nationwide, that's a federal drug fund, by the way. It was worth about $1.5 billion. The government took it to plug the budget gap. So now there's almost no money left. This is what Congress did. This is unbelievable, Fran. Unbelievable. Congress.
I believe it.
Now
they are unbelievable.
This money was earmarked. It was in a federal. It was in federal accounts. But it was earmarked for local municipalities that had taken the money. This wasn't the government's money. It was it belonged to the local municipalities like Reminderville, Ohio, like the hometowns of a lot of people who are listening to your show right now. Congress takes it $1.5 billion to help plug the budget gap in the last deal that they struck, right? Mm-hmm. Now a cop like Jeff Buck wants to take $100,000 out of his fund in order to run a drug operation, because a drug operation, it's very expensive to run. That's one of the things you see in the book. That's one of the things you see in Takedown.
Mm-hmm.
You've got surveillance is expensive. The manpower is expensive. The wire is expensive. All these things are expensive. And what Jeff Buck has always been able to do, he calls it what is the term in the drug world is walking money. If you're going to be an undercover guy and you're going to buy drugs, and that's how you nail people, you nail them with the product. You've got to have the money to say, okay, here's $50,000, pay me the drugs. Now, you've marked those bills. So when they start showing up, when you arrest the guy finally, and you show that he's got the 50, because remember, it's not Jeff Buck doing the arrest, because Jeff Buck is an undercover officer.
Yeah.
So somebody else arrests him, there's the $50,000 in marked bills. Now they know that it's definitely the product of a drug deal because they have it all those serial numbers are logged. But thanks to the federal government, thanks to Congress, that $100,000 Jeff would need tomorrow to mount a big investigation, to put $50,000 in walking money so he can make a drug deal that will ultimately bring down a kingpin, gone.
Well, my question is this, too, as I'm sitting here writing with my questions in front of me. These drug pin people are supposedly not too smart, or they are smart. They've been getting away with it. And yet they can't be that smart because they're getting caught in a sting that they don't even realize, which makes me feel so much better. But, if anybody said Reminderville, Ohio, a small town in Jeff Buck, they would never believe in a small town you have a chief of police that's so brilliant that we could probably use here in New York City, too. You know, somebody like that that doesn't stop until he gets it done. So it took a lot of planning and everything, and he was called the Dope Ghost, right? They used to call him that?
Yeah, it was his nickname in the drug world, yes.
Yeah, he was amazing because I love the fact that he tells the story. So I felt at times that I'm sitting here saying, oh, I hope he gets the guy. I hope the guy gets whatever. I hope nobody gets hurt. And, of course, people do. And the biker wars. And then there's Mark Rube. And then there's Sonny. And there's so many people that I don't want to give away all of them. There's so many characters. The list of real life characters is what makes the story come to life. And when they're arrested and caught, he took down what he could take down. How do you
exactly.
make this stick? How do you make this stick so they don't get away with it? Because these people are powerful, some of them.
Well, the way you do it is, you know, the people who aren't charged are normally people who have given up people above them. It's all about taking down the kingpin. And the way you judge a successful drug operation is if the price of drugs escalates after you take the kingpin down. You have the reason it escalates, which means supply goes down, demand goes down because the price is soaring. It's because you took his drugs off the street. And more important, when he comes out of jail, all his assets have been taken. All his, you know, he has nothing. And everyone knows he was arrested. So it's very hard for these kingpins to reestablish themselves in the drug world because they don't have. Because here's the thing. When you're established in this business and everything goes up the food chain, you are buying drugs at every level, and you're buying it what's called on the arm, which means you give me the drugs. You give me $100,000 worth of drugs. I'm going to sell them for $300,000. I'm going to keep $100,000. I'm going to give you $100,000. Now, this keeps getting cut down up the food chain. That's basically what happens. But I don't have to give you any money up front. What happens when a guy like Jeff brings down a gang, there's no one left to front the money on the arm, as they say. So you cut out a lot of huge dealers, potentially huge dealers, because nobody is there to give them credit anymore. It's like what happens when you have bad credit in the real world. You desperately need to get a credit card, but you can't because you have bad credit, so you can't buy what you want. Picture that in the drug world, when a new organization is coming in to replace the old one, there isn't the product, and you don't have the supply chain that can front the product to whatever product you can get. The dealer, you can't afford to front the product. You need the money up front, but very few of these people have that money. So taking down a drug gang and how you can quantify the success, because the reason, especially with weed, these guys are so – you asked about intelligence. Most of these guys, the kingpins, are exceptionally smart people. They're businessmen. They are not violent. And in one case, the epilogue of the book, Jeff spent all, you know, years going after this guy. And the guy is a multimillionaire, right? This is the meatpacking guy.
Yeah.
And finally he nails him, right? And this is in the epilogue.
Yeah.
And he says to him, and the guy's name on the street was Richie Rich. His nickname in the drug world was Richie Rich because he was so rich. So Jeff said to him, "Why are you doing this?" And it was basically the thrill. The guy never did a drug in his life, made himself rich in other businesses, and ended up as a billion-dollar drug distributor. This guy was running his business like Walmart, to a point where all the weed was shipped in 18-wheelers in pallets, and it was dated. And if ever any was returned because it was spoiled or skunked or whatever, you know, the right terms are in the drug world, he would charge a restocking fee, just like you do if you bring back an item to Walmart. These people are so sophisticated that literally, and this is how they become as successful as they are. And here's the point of the book. Here's the point of Takedown. If you go after If you go after the lowest rungs of the ladder and you stop there, and this is the frustration Jeff had when he started the case. When he got to New York and he started to get an idea of how big the case was, the DEA, one of the DEA agents he was working with, said, "Okay, here's what we'll do. We'll set up a sting. We'll nail your guy Kevin in Beachwood." We're back to Kevin in Beachwood again. We'll nail him. We'll get $1 million, and we'll split the forfeiture 50-50, $500,000, $500,000. Jeff looks at the guy, and he calls the guy an ass clown. He doesn't call it, but that in his head, that's what these people are who are committed to destroying drug investigations. And he said, "Look, I didn't need to drive 8 hours to do something I could have done myself in my own backyard. I don't need you to bust a guy at this level. I need you because I want the guy who's supplying him with the drugs, and I want
That's
the
right.
Hell's Angels who are supplying them with the drugs. In other words, most law enforcement are satisfied with taking a dealer, a user, a small-time distributor off the street, and that's it.
Yeah, but
the
big guy's still there selling. Right, exactly.
Well, that's the thing. Jeff Buck has something called the bad news talk. He'll be following a drug dealer, and he'll pull him over, get him in the back of his car, take him into a parking lot. He'll put him in the back seat, get in with him, say, all right, here's the thing. We've got 15 minutes. You've got 15 minutes to change your life. I've got you. I know your kids' names. I know the schools they go to. I know where the money is coming from to pay for those schools. I'm going to take everything you own. I'm going to take your house. I'm going to take your cars. I'm going to take your boat. I'm going to take your kids' college fund because I know where that money came from, and you know I know it. Now, in 15 minutes, they're going to know something's wrong because you didn't call in or you didn't get to where you're supposed to go. So you've got 15 minutes to make a deal. Give me what I want. And you could be looking, right now you're looking at 25 years. I can get that down as little as zero if you work with me. So you got a choice, 25 years in jail, 15 years in jail, or no jail time. That's the bad news talk. That person almost invariably will, now there's no, now what Jeff will say is, notice I haven't arrested you, I haven't charged you, I haven't Mirandized you. Because once I do that, I can't have this conversation with you. Once I Mirandize you, we're done. So tell me, how do you want to play this? That's what Jeff Buck does. A lot of cops just arrest that guy, put him in jail. And after 20 minutes, he's useless. Because after these people are so sophisticated. There are chase cars which lead the way for big shipments. They're called chase cars, but they're in front. And what they do is they look for roadblocks. Most drug stops happen on highways, believe it or not. Informants, smart cops who just can tell a drug runner. This is why in Takedown, one of the great things that Kevin does is when he takes over part of the operation after the guy is murdered by the Indian by the Indian tribal leader, he has his father do the driving with the drugs. Because cops are much less likely to pull over an adult than they are a kid. And, you know, this isn't rocket science, Fran, because when Jeff Buck started investigating Kevin Sorin, that's Kevin from Beachwood, the drug dealer, you've got a 22-year-old kid living with his 20-year-old girlfriend in a $500,000 home with $1 million worth of with a $250,000 worth of furnishings who's showing no income on his tax returns. Well, how's he making his money? Now, again, the difference with Jeff Buck is he could have nailed Kevin that day, but he wanted to use Kevin to get him to Alan Jacobs on the Indian Reservation, Noah, who took over, this guy Noah King, who took over for Alan Jacobs as the kingpin when Alan went away on the murder beef, which that I mentioned before. So you've got these characters, you know, who range, and this is the beauty of this story. You have the characters who range from multimillionaires, businessmen, to literally hillbillies lower down the chain who are no more than farmers growing pot in a field. But then you've got this unholy alliance of this Indian reservation. And by the way, Takedown is a microcosm of the entire northern border. You've got Indian reservations in Wyoming, Montana, Washington, Michigan. They're all this is happening at all of them. A great number of them. Some of them are dealing with the cartels out of Mexico. If they can't get their weed and their pills and their drugs from the Hells Angels out of Canada, because as you move farther west, the Hells Angels' power diminishes a little bit. The Hells Angels, even now, are far more powerful in the metropolitan areas of Toronto and Montreal. They have an office building they use in Chicago. We talk about in the book. The Hells Angels out of Canada actually are headquartered in Chicago. Jeff Buck learned this, and part of their – this give a little bit away. Part of the seizure of this case was the assets of that office building that the Hells Angels owned.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that was split with the Canadian authorities. Jeff had a counterpart north of the border who was working something called Operation Shark, S-H-A-R-Q. It's not shark as in the fish. It's a French acronym. So he would meet his old friend Frenchie, who was an undercover cop with the Ontario Provincial Police, regularly, and they would discuss. They were jointly working the operation. Why is that important? Because the key to drug takedowns, the key to when it's time, is it's got to be a coordinated effort, Fran. Because if you don't take everybody down at once, word gets out, the bust is on, and people go, they disappear into the wind. They vanish. So there was tremendous coordination between the Canadian authorities from Operation Shark and the American authorities with Jeff Buck and that upstate. Mm-hmm. And the task force was centered in upstate New York, but it was staffed by Jeff Buck's cops, his people from Ohio, because the DEA didn't have the manpower or the money to fund the operation, believe it or not. Here's an interesting fact, too. I found this fascinating. You know, I alluded to before about this federal assets and seizure fund money that should go to local municipalities. Well, Fran, on the surface, there seems to be a disconnect there. If this is local money, how did it end up with the government? Why is the government dispensing it? Why did the government even have the right to seize it? Believe it or not, they seized the seized money to plug the budget gap. Here's why. If Jeff Buck goes into state court on a drug case, he has to prove that all the revenue that these people are that he has found these people have, all their assets, their boats and their mansions, he has to prove that they bought those through drug money. In federal court, the burden is reversed. The people have to prove that it wasn't the proceeds, all this stuff wasn't purchased through the proceeds of drug money. So what you do is you make your case on the local level. Then you bring in the DEA as a kind of like a subcontractor, because that way you prosecute. It becomes a federal warrant instead of a state warrant. Much different. This is another thing that sometimes people in smaller police departments don't understand, because the great thing about this book is, in addition to everything else, it's like for law enforcement, it's like a how to make a drug case. And what you find in it is that the smallest officer, the smallest police department can do a drug case. If they trust their drug officers, if they coordinate with other task forces. There are drug task forces in pretty much every city and large municipality in the country. The problem we have when a guy like Jeff Buck isn't involved is they don't talk to each other. One of Jeff Buck's big goals is to create, first in Ohio, a statewide database so that local police departments know who the dealers are, and then a national database. It's really a world unto itself. I don't know how else to describe it.
There's absolutely, I'm wondering, I'm listening, no way to actually take down all of them. There are a lot of takedowns in the book, by the way, people, not just the one at the end. I know, I got that. And then when I'm looking at the sentences at the end, I said he did a great job, but I got angry because you want people to get more time, but I guess they have to. And then what concerns me is that what happens now when some of these people are going to be released, because some of them didn't get very long sentences, maybe 3 years, 4 years. And I didn't want to bring in the bartender, is Whiskers. He was a character in himself. And
Whiskers is the guy on that bar the tribal leader as a boy meets? Is that who introduces him to the Hells Angels? Isn't that a fascinating story?
The whole thing was fascinating. Randy Thor, Joe Mons, every one of them, and got into it. What scares me is that when they get out, some of these lower kingpin, lower people, you know, might find their way back in and not have a problem. So Jeff Buck is still, he's not doing this anymore, right? Is he doing this or not?
Well, actually,
I love him. I think he's great.
There's breaking news. If you'll notice, you didn't see in the hardcover, and if you look for publicity, there are no pictures of Jeff Buck associated with this on any website.
I only have the one you sent me.
I've got pictures of him undercover that I can circulate, but we're not showing his face in any interview. Because the problem he is considering there is a major investigation, he's not allowed to tell me the details. It is a huge case. It is nationwide. It's international. And they have asked, he has been approached to be the guy.
Once again?
To become the co-host.
So how does Kathy feel about that, his wife? I mean, she's amazing. I don't know if I could deal with that.
It's a great point. But Kathy's answer to that is this. When he's doing a drug investigation, he's in control. One of the scenes that opened the book is a takedown, and he's got the walking money. He's about to buy cocaine, and I'll get, you know, this is just an anecdote to illustrate the point to your question. And he gives the he's wired up, and he's got an informant with him who's sweating like hell. Looks like Marco Rubio, just pouring flop sweat. The guy knows he's going to lose it. Now he's not armed, but he's in a barn, and he's in a barn because the kingpin he's about to bring down raises champion horses. So there's a horse, like a champion horse is in the barn, and he gets word, he gives the signal over his earpiece, you know, the code word. Nothing happens. Nobody shows up.
That's right. That got me nervous. I got shaky.
So
I remember that.
He starts talking about what happened was his takedown team was stuck behind a school bus. Literally.
That's the worst.
Make this stuff up. Now, the reason I raise that is because you were asking me, because the original question was about Jeff and
His family and Kathy.
That's an exception to the rule. Mostly, Jeff is in control. That and Kathy knows that. But when he's going, when he's just as a chief of police and he goes on a traffic stop, more cops are killed in traffic stops than in shootouts right now. Well, I mean, sometimes there's shootouts as a result of traffic stops. Traffic stops are the most dangerous thing going. You never know what you're going to find. It's the unknown. So Kathy feels much safer when he's away undercover than when he is just kicking in a door for a domestic violence case or pulling over a driver who has expired plates. Those are the most dangerous things. Now, they have a whole code thing. When they're together, sometimes it's inevitable that he will be recognized as his alias, as the dope ghost. One of the names he used as when he was Dope Ghost. So they have a whole thing where she will either quickly get away, or they go into the guise where she has to give the background of the person that the guy thinks Jeff is, not her own family situation, not their own location.
Somebody else, yeah.
The thing you are always aware, and this is there's so much great stuff. I mean, as we're talking, more and more is coming to me. There's something called a heat run. And what basically is a heat run is you lead someone on a crazy, winding route to get to a destination to make sure you're not being followed. Jeff Buck, every time he would leave when he's undercover, but a lot of times you're undercover, you still go home at night. It's not like, you know, you don't have a lot. You do go home. So Jeff's undercover, but he doesn't want to lead the people he's infiltrated back to his real identity. So he'll do heat runs every night where he'll drive around, then he'll pull into a parking lot. And he'll wait and see if anyone pulls in after him. If no one does, he knows he's safe. And then he drives home. It is a world unto itself in the sense that you are constantly aware of your double life, that you have these two worlds. This was done beautifully in Donnie Brasco with Johnny Depp and Al Pacino, mm-hmm. I think, an older movie. You saw it a little bit in Goodfellas and how this all, you know, how, and look, and here's the thing. And when I talk about Takedown as, you know, not having any gunfights, you know something else? The most famous drug case in American history is probably the one that was immortalized in The French Connection with Gene Hackman. There was a cop named in New York named Popeye Doyle, who, by the way, never got the drugs. He uncovered the network. He did dismantle the network, but he never got the drugs like Jeff Buck always does. In the movie, there's car chases. There's chases on a train track. None of that ever happened. Because the thing about these cases are there aren't car chases. There aren't gunfights. Drug cases, making a drug case is about informants. The worst weapon, the best weapon in the war on drugs is intelligence. And you can get that intelligence via drones, via wiretaps, via Title Threes is what the wiretaps are called. Informants who are giving you all this stuff, someone who's willing to wear a wire. This is police work. It isn't dramatic. It's police work. And if you're a gunfighter in this business, you're not going to be in this business long.
Well, before I forget, and I forget nothing, which is really good. That's what my husband says. Oh, my God. Tomorrow, I usually don't have two shows in 1 week, but I made an exception. Brian Freeman, Goodbye to the Dead, tomorrow morning at 10. Oh, wow. Let me tell you, that's really good.
Brian Freeman won a big award. I think he won the Thriller Award at ITW one year.
He did
for
that. Yes. And
yes.
I said that he, and I'm hoping, and he quoted me on his website, but he better quote me on the back of the real book because I worked hard on that one. 316, Carl Brookins, The Yellow Diamond Caper, 322. This is going to be exciting because I love roller derby, and Todd Patterson was a real roller derby star. In the San Francisco Bay Area Bombers, and he's going to be on the show. 324, finally, Simon Chavez, Thin Black Line. And on 331, Alan Topo, The Italian Divide. And I have to tell you that my picks for the week are Andrea Kane, The Murder That Never Was. And yes, she asked me for some blurbs for her back cover. I hope they use them. The book was absolutely fantastic. What happens when a doctor once is so out of his mind that he wants to create the perfect Olympic athlete with performance-enhanced drugs. That's all I'm going to say about that. Joy Fielding, she's not there. And this morning, just about an hour ago, I finished my review for Gone Again by James Crepando. Let me tell you, I've been getting some good stuff, but I'm waiting for your new one. When is that coming out?
We'll see Caitlin back in Strong Cold Dead in October, October 4th.
Oh, wow. And when are you bringing back my favorite character?
You know what?
That's Michael.
If I knew that, I'd answer it. So we're gonna have to take a rain check on Michael Toronto for now.
Oh, that's so sad.
Well, you know the thing about and I know you like talking about the writing process. Nonfiction is a team effort, and you accept
that. Yeah, so I was gonna ask you next how you got this together.
We'll talk about that, but it's a perfect segue. I write the Toronto books with somebody else as a work for hire, and I hate the process. I despise the process. I loathe the process. And I'm doing it again for the same guy. It's impossible for me to imagine ever doing it a fourth time. It's miserable. It's misery. It's because the creative process for fiction and nonfiction are apples and oranges.
Mm-hmm.
Fiction is creating. Nonfiction is – it's. Well, let me put it this way. When I write fiction, I'm trying to make my characters feel real. When I write nonfiction, I try to make my characters feel like fictional characters. It's the exact opposite.
Mm-hmm.
And you're looking for those ways. So that's a segue into that next thing about the process, which is fascinating.
Are you going to write if this other thing that you mentioned that he has to do again happens, are you going to write another one? And tell everybody what happened. You're going to write another nonfiction.
You know what? I am. The thing I like about nonfiction is it isn't. It is a different kind of challenge. It's kind of like what Kathy Buck said about Jeff in comparing his undercover world to his day-to-day world. Where you, in fiction, it's like Jeff Buck's day-to-day world for me. I never know what's going to happen next, and it's my job to figure it out.
He must live on the edge.
He does. Seriously. In the undercover world, though, he knows he is working to a template in a guise, and that's what nonfiction is like, because it's given to me, and I make it better, or I find the story and the structure. That's what we started this off by talking about, what my contribution, where I come in, was. And the thing is, and I did this with my first nonfiction book, Betrayal, as well, you need to find the structure, because nonfiction doesn't have a beginning, a convenient middle, beginning, middle, and end. The great stories in nonfiction do, but not all nonfiction does. So you need to find a structure. In the case of Takedown, a book that I thought was going to be an action-filled book that had no action, how do I find the structure? And that's where I settled upon with Lindsay the idea that we would do alternating timelines that would eventually converge, that we would be telling Jeff's story. But where do you put all the anecdotes? Where do you put the background? Where do you put this and that? You know, it's very, very difficult. That's the challenge. So my job in nonfiction is to take somebody's work, and a lot of times, in the case of Jeff Buck, he hadn't written a word. Lindsay interviewed him, you know, for 3 to 5 straight days, and then wrote a lot of the chapters. And then what I did was I supplemented. I found the structure, but then I realized as the book went on that Lindsay had done a great job at the chronology, a brilliant job. But what was missing was the most important thing. Now, I didn't realize this organically. This came to me as I was starting. It wasn't like an aha moment. What was missing was what I just mentioned. What was missing was Jeff Buck's voice. The job of the nonfiction writer, more than anything else, especially in a first-person memoir, which is exclusively what I do, is to find the voice of the hero, how they speak. And what was missing in the early drafts was Jeff Buck. We had lost him somehow. So I spent hours and hours and hours myself talking to Jeff. And that's how I got the story about the meatpacking guy and the sides of beef. That's how I got the story. That's how I got all these great anecdotes about Sunshine, the LSD dealer. And I started typing as fast as I could, to the point where a huge portion of this book is literally Jeff Buck talking to you as the reader. In his the way he speaks, his cadence, the way it's like a screenplay almost in that respect, a voiceover. Even when he's narrating the things he wasn't there to see, because that's the challenge of nonfiction. We need to have a we need to have confession time. When you read anyone out there reading who loves nonfiction. And you get this conversation between characters, neither of whom may be alive anymore, or neither of whom the author may have interviewed, maybe one of whom. Well, how does that author know what they said? How do you know exactly what was exchanged? Especially like in Eric Larson's great books, a lot of the people he writes about, nobody survived. You know, the Lusitania was his last book. Well, who are you going to talk to from the Lusitania? There's nobody left. So when so the dialogue tends to be fictionalized. You find out what the subject was. You create the dialogue. For instance, in Takedown, I knew the two Hell's Angels. My research revealed two Hell's Angels who were involved in the drug trade. Did I know for a fact that they were driving a truck on a certain night loaded with weed they were delivering to the Indian reservation? No. Was I in the truck when they were speaking? No. That's what fiction does. That's what good narrative nonfiction is. It's telling the story accurately, but it's inspired by something. It's based on something. It isn't the blow-by-blow depiction, everything that happened exactly as it happened. Now, Lindsay interviewed almost all the living principals, and got their dialogue, got them to reconstruct conversations as best as they could. Not necessarily the exact words, because nobody remembers the exact words, but what was the subject of the conversation? I'm not the only one who does this. The great nonfiction writers of all time, including Truman Capote in Cold Blood, are, you know, do this as well. Mm-hmm. It's creating a story. It's bringing something to life. When I write fiction, I'm always thinking about where is the light coming from. I want to know in every scene, what are the smells? Mm. What are the sounds? And my conversations with Jeff Buck were so great. And I got to tell you, though, I didn't find that magic moment that, you know, there was no thing in his life where he becomes an obsessed anti-drug crusader because a child or a relative died of drugs. It was nothing like that. There was nothing dramatic like that. And you can't invent something like that. There was no, like, I said to him, you know, he raises horses, draft horses that are related to Clydesdales. And these are champion horses. So I was trying to find some link between his work with the horses and his drug work. I was trying to find this beautiful metaphor that I would look for in fiction. You know, I always remember the last scene of the great documentary film Woodstock. The last scene of Woodstock, or the virtual last scene of Woodstock, is an interview with the guy who comes to clean the porta-johns. And the guy's got a son who's at Woodstock, and he's got a son in Vietnam. And he's talking about this as he's putting that vacuum-like hose into these porta-johns and sucking out whatever it was. So here it is. It's the end of the peace generation. It's the end of that whole era with Woodstock. Altamont was just 6 months later, the Speedway. And you've got a guy who's cleaning toilets. That beautiful image that transcends reality. I didn't find anything like that in Takedown, but I found some of those anecdotes that I gave you. So it comes down to beginning, middle, and end. Structuring a nonfiction story like a novel. And that's what that was my job.
Well, you did. Before we close, I have a very odd question. Two of them, little ones. By taking down so many, you can never really take down them all. I know that. What is the message that if Jeff Buck, well, we don't want to hear his voice because we don't want to know who he is. What if he could speak to the audience and tell them what he hoped to, the message he hoped to send out to drug dealers, to Hell's Angels, to the Rock Machine, and anybody else? I'm sure there are more than that, those drug cartels. What is the message that they're trying to get out with this book? And number two, where can we find out more about the book and, of course, about John Land?
You know, there's a lot online already. I haven't got a lot about it on my website, johnlandbooks.com. That's not a good place to go in this case. But plenty of stuff. If you just Google Takedown by Jeff Buck, you'll get all kinds of stuff. There's some great excerpts on criminal. There's a great excerpt on Criminal Element. Go to my Twitter feed at John D. Land. There's all kinds of links. But the answer to your question is I don't think what Jeff Buck's message is aimed necessarily at the bad guys, because the bad guys don't care. If the bad guys cared, they wouldn't be bad guys. There was one guy that Jeff was after for 3 years. He knew where the general area where the guy lived, but he couldn't find him. The guy was literally off the grid. One day he's driving through this area for the 100th time. He passes a house with trash. It's trash day. There are trash barrels outside. One of the trash barrels has the guy's name on it. And that's when he knew he had found the guy he'd been looking with for 3 years. What's my point? Jeff's message is aimed at law enforcement officers that you can do what I do, that the war on drugs is real. Marijuana is not harmless. That if marijuana was legalized tomorrow, only 15% nationwide, only 15% of all marijuana sales would be over the counter. Most 85% of them would still be, and here's the most important point we've gotten to today. Marijuana is the number one cash crop of the drug world. It fuels everything else bad guys do. It fuels prostitution. In the Hell's Angels, when they were busted, one of the houses they were busted at had young girls, some no older than 12, who were basically had been stolen to white slavery. Human trafficking. The money to pay buy that house, the money to feed those girls, the money, you know, it comes from weed sales. So there's marijuana in the world of drugs is not a victimless crime. It is fueling gun sales. It is fueling the people in this world who are violent, the gangs. They use the marijuana sales because remember, marijuana. Here's something that people don't realize: marijuana. The feds will not be interested in a marijuana case unless it's 400 pounds or more. That means between 0 and 400 pounds, the feds don't care. They don't care. It's not big enough for them. So it's up to local municipalities who are understaffed, have no money, and now just had their asset funds drained by the Congress. So how are you – but that 399 pounds, which is not a federal – which nobody cares about at the federal level, is the street value is astronomical. And it's going to buy – It's used for the proceeds of crime that goes into things that honestly hurt people. Because the real drug dealer is living next door to you. The real dangerous kingpins are not like El Chapo. That is a cartoon. It's a caricature. The guys, they live right next door to you and your readers, your listeners, in suburbia. They go to church. They go to temple. They shop at all the same stores. They're businessmen. They're making a fortune, and the money they make that gets reinvested somewhere. Ultimately, there are bad guys out there they're dealing with who are putting guns on the street, who are putting heroin on the street that's killing people. All right, weed doesn't kill people. I understand that. But weed supplies the funding that allows the heroin trade, the drug trade, the gun trade.
And these
trade.
Kids want it. Yeah, I know. It reminds me of something Ken Sehu that said yesterday. They were at a tryout for a specific team, whatever, and they weren't looking. It was amazing. The person told me that they were smoking weed. They were drinking alcohol. These were kids, 15 to 17, that were trying out for a team. And the coaches and everybody were standing there, and nobody did anything to stop what was going on. It's scary. And what scares me is that it filters down into the high school, and some kid that has nothing is going to use it to get money and sell like the runners did in the book. But we have about one whole minute, and I'm looking forward to reading the next Caitlin Strong book, and I'm looking forward to if you ever write the other one. I get why you don't want to do it.
Well, I'll give you a little advance preview. Strong Cold Dead takes place in large part on an Indian reservation in Texas. Nothing about drugs, but a great MacGuffin, as Hitchcock would call it.
The sooner I can write something lovely. And,
absolutely.
I'm very honored that Daniel Palmer. I just finished reading Mercy. I have to set up an interview with him in May. And I turned over the book, and I was quoted on the back cover, and I got all excited. Then I took a picture of it and sent it to everybody in my family that doesn't know what I do.
Oh, that's so
and
great.
I was hysterical. Andrea Kane is supposed to use some of my blurbs in her book, too. I really hope she does, because the book was absolutely fantastic. They sent it to me on Saturday, said, could you read it by Monday? And I did. I just sat down and read it. And the James Grappando book, you got to read it. I mean, she's gone again. Sashi is missing, and I learned some terms about adoption and rehoming and a whole bunch of interesting stuff that he used his legal expertise in the book. So it's great. So John, you are absolutely my favorite person. And I hope we get to do this soon, and I hope I get to see you at the Thriller Fest because. People are
you
saying,
will.
Are you coming? I don't know. I hope so because...
Yes, you are. You and your husband, Jeffrey, will be there.
Good, because we're going to be there. And Jeff is very excited because he wants to go to some of the workshops that we missed last time. So that'll be great. So thank you so very much. Everybody, it's beautiful outside. Get outside, take a walk, enjoy the sunshine because Monday it's going to rain. they said, maybe, maybe not. And thank you so much. You are still my very favorite person in the whole world.
Thank you, Fran.
You're welcome. Have a nice day, everybody, and bye.